Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Perhaps the greatest twist endings in film comes from the 1995 movie The Usual Suspects. And if you haven't seen it, well, it's been out for nearly 30 years, so spoiler alert. At the very end of the movie, the detective realizes, too late, that he's been masterfully deceived. He's just spent hours interviewing a meek, mild-mannered man, a supposed sidekick, a nobody. Just an unlucky accomplice to a much bigger villain, a criminal mastermind named Kaiser Soze. The man tells a story. He's emotional, nervous, believable. When the interrogation ends, he posts bail, and the detective is satisfied he'd solved the case. The suspect limps out of the police station and shuffles down the sidewalk, but as the detective smugly takes a sip of his coffee and looks around the office walls, it all snaps into focus. Everything he'd just heard was a complete lie, a fabricated narrative stitched together from observed details around the room. Names on the bulletin board, details on wanted posters, even the brand of the detective's coffee cup. Meanwhile, outside the station, the suspect's limp fades, his stride straightens, he walks off confident, free. The detective and the audience make the connection at the exact same moment. The man he thought was a nobody was Kaiser Soze all along. Now, imagine if that kind of deception didn't come from a stranger across an interrogation table, but from somebody you trusted. Someone with access to your world, your work, your home. Someone you'd never think to doubt.
We lock our doors at night to keep the outside world, to keep evil out, right? But what happens when evil has a key? Can't prepare for that.
In 2013, three inseparable friends from Raleigh, North Carolina, found themselves entangled in a web of deception. But this wasn't fiction, and the lies didn't come from items around a room. One of them had been crafting stories from the lives of people around him, borrowing symptoms, conditions, and even grief, all to draw sympathy and to keep attention away from darker truths. Join me now as we examine the senseless murder of Jamie Hahn, a rising political strategist with a sharp mind, a giving heart, and a future full of promise. You'll hear a chilling story of trust and loyalty built over the years and shattered in a single brutal act of violence, and how a trail of missing money revealed the man living behind a carefully constructed mask, one he would do anything to protect. As the saying goes, you can't make old friends, because lifelong friends are exactly that. Friends you've known since childhood. For Nation Hahn and Jonathan Broyhill, that friendship began in their hometown of Lenoir, North Carolina, a small town in the Appalachian foothills, where social life often revolved around church activities.
So summer of 2000, we were at church, went to the same church.
This is Nation Hahn, remembering how he first met Jonathan.
I guess I was 14, and I had a crush on this girl that went to church, so I started going to church more.
at least more frequently, like Sunday nights, Wednesday nights. And there was a church trip planned, I think, to Daytona Beach. She was like, oh, you should come. And so I signed up. And I'd seen him before around the church because our families went to the same church, but I didn't know him particularly well. And on that trip, he was a chaperone of youth. And so over the course of that trip, we interacted. And I think that was really when we began to be friends.
Jonathan was 4 years older than Nation, but the two hit it off quickly and started hanging out. They bonded over their shared progressive political beliefs, a sharp contrast to the predominantly conservative community around them.
We hung out semi-frequently, a couple times a week, usually. I didn't have a license, and so, you know, he would come pick us up, pick me up, and, you know, we'd go off and hang out with other friends from church, or sometimes the two of us would go, sometimes the two of us and my sister would go. We hung out quite a bit.
When Nation graduated high school, he and Jonathan's paths began to diverge. Nation went on to attend the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John, meanwhile, stayed in Lenore, working at a local supermarket.
We would see each other on major holidays and sometimes when I was home on summer break, but we did hang out a lot less frequently while I was in college. He came down to visit once or maybe twice. I think it was twice when I was there, sort of more towards my junior or senior year.
While at UNC, Nation's focus shifted toward national politics. It was that interest that eventually led him to Jamie Kirk, a dynamic woman working on John Edwards' presidential campaign.
An email went over a listserv asking for volunteers for a presidential campaign. So I showed up. I didn't meet her that night, but I kept emailing her, basically begging for a task to be involved. So finally, I think out of exasperation more than anything, she gave me something to do. So I showed up. This was probably end of January 2007 for a fundraiser, and they led me back to her, and that's where I met her.
Jamie, who was 2 years older than Nation, had already graduated from UNC the previous year.
And so I was working at Jamie's discretion. So she was teaching me the ropes on fundraising. And after probably 2 to 3 months of working with her and working in the North Carolina portion of the campaign, I moved over to another fundraising portion, still interning. But we remained very good friends, and I would help her out on an ongoing basis. And I had a huge crush on her, to the point where I think sometimes she would ask friends if they would go along with us to not give me the wrong idea. But as time went along, we spent more and more time together.
Throughout his senior year at UNC, Nation continued working closely with Jamie on the Edwards campaign.
And so I just continued having a crush on her. And, you know, I thought she was the most beautiful, remarkable person that I'd ever met. And, you know, we went out to lunch probably 3 or 4 times a week. And I remember the presidential campaign ended, the candidate dropped out at the end of January. This was would have been in 2008. The candidate and his spouse threw a thank you party. And so we all went, and Jamie came into town, and everyone, you know, was drinking beers and drinking wine. And we went out in the patio, and my recollection is she leaned in and kissed me. She might tell you a different story. But we kissed that night, and from there started dating.
Jamie was outgoing and warm, with a passion for making a difference through political work. She had an infectious energy that drew people in. Colleagues sought out her insight. Friends gravitated toward her kindness, and even strangers opened up to her within minutes. Within 4 months of their first kiss, Nation and Jamie were engaged. As their relationship deepened, Nation was eager to introduce Jamie to the people who mattered most, his family and his longtime friend Jonathan.
Called him and another friend, said, you know, I'd love for you to meet Jamie. She means a lot to me, etc. And so on our way out of town, we stopped by and had, you know, a drink with him and another friend at the friend's home. He and Jamie became close pretty quickly.
Nation was excited to see his old best friend getting along so well with his new fiance. By then, Jonathan had a job at a mental health agency in Lenore that he downplayed as just pushing paper. As the three of them grew together, Jonathan began opening up about something else, something that was making his life harder in his hometown.
He came out and visited us in Charleston, and that was when he came out and told us both that he was gay for the first time. And, you know, Jamie was very understanding. I was too, but Jamie was very understanding and immediately, you know, had already become friends with him, but became closer friends.
Coming out to Nation and Jamie marked a turning point in their friendship. It was something Jonathan hadn't even shared with his own family, and in that moment, a deeper bond formed between the three of them.
He and some other friends would host an engagement party for us in Lenore, but over time, we moved to Raleigh, and he would come down and visit periodically, and Jamie would always encourage him that, you know, Raleigh's a great place to be. You should think about moving down here. You know, I think you'd meet a lot of people you'd like.
Nation and Jamie believed Jonathan's life might be easier in a bigger city. More people, more opportunities, and most importantly, a place where he could truly be himself without the pressure to hide. When Nation and Jamie married in April of 2009, Jonathan, of course, stood beside him as his best man. Just a few months later, Jonathan made the move to Raleigh.
I guess it was late summer. He was working at that time for a company, and they had a Raleigh office. And so he told us that he thought he could get a transfer, and then finally he did get a transfer. Jamie said, you know, while you're looking for a roommate, you can use our guest bedroom, and he would. And then he ultimately found him a place to live. We helped him find a roommate.
After moving to Raleigh, Jonathan, Nation, and Jamie became inseparable, more like family than friends. He became a regular presence at their dinner table, joined them on holidays, and often stayed overnight. Jonathan spent so much time at their house that most neighbors assumed he lived there. Just before Jonathan's big move to Raleigh, Jamie launched her own political consulting firm. She called it Sky Blue Strategies, focused on fundraising for local nonprofits and progressive campaigns. At first, it was a one-woman operation, with Jamie handling everything herself. She had a natural talent for the work, connecting with people instantly, understanding what moved them, and building relationships that lasted. But it wasn't just a business. Jamie believed in the causes she supported. For her, this was more than a job. It was a calling, a way to make a difference. And before long, her reputation grew, and so did her workload.
I guess it was spring of 2010. She was just drowning at work. She's so busy. And she really needed an additional person to help her primarily with the Jane Dyer campaign. But the campaign couldn't afford to pay another person, so it would have to be sort of on her dime or on Sky Blue's dime. And she started thinking about the sort of cost-benefit analysis of bringing someone in.
Jamie realized she had a perfect opportunity, one that could help her and someone she now considered one of her closest friends. She offered Jonathan the job.
He had always been interested in politics, and he had, you know, talked about wanting to get a political campaign. I think he had applied for one or two sort of political or governmental affairs type jobs here in Raleigh and hadn't gotten them. She made the decision to bring him on to help her with the workload, would help on, I know, compliance, which is the filing of reports to the FEC, and those would be like incoming donations, outgoing receipts. He was responsible for cutting the checks, checking the mail.
With Jonathan on board, Jamie finally had room to breathe. She could focus on what she did best, fundraising, strategy, and big picture thinking. Jonathan balanced the books, prepared the reports, and quickly became Jamie's most trusted sidekick. By 2011, the dynamic duo at Sky Blue Strategies landed its biggest client yet. Sitting U.S. Congressman Brad Miller hired Jamie to manage his campaign funds. It was the kind of account that could put a small shop like Sky Blue on the map. And for a while, everything was perfect. At just 27, Jamie was making a name for herself as a rising star in the world of campaign fundraising. And Jonathan, at 29, had finally found his footing, both professionally and socially. Not only was he hanging out with his two best friends almost every day, for the first time in his life, he felt like he truly belonged somewhere, accepted for who he was, and trusted with important responsibilities. If this were a movie, 2011 would be the golden montage. You know the one. Upbeat music swelling over quick cuts of Jamie closing deals. Jonathan bent over spreadsheets with the satisfied focus of someone working on something meaningful. The three of them laughing over dinner, windows down on road trips, successful campaign events, inside jokes, spontaneous hugs and high fives. But as the music fades, the camera lingers on the one last perfect shot. Nation, Jamie, and Jonathan at the top of their game. Because sometimes when everything feels most perfect, it's exactly when everything starts to fall apart. In early 2012, the Brad Miller campaign made a surprising announcement. He would not be seeking re-election to the U.S. Congress. It was a bombshell for Sky Blue Strategies. With the campaign suspended, there'd be no more fundraising needed. Instead, Jamie and Jonathan were tasked with winding things down. Outstanding obligations needed to be paid. Remaining funds had to be returned to donors or transferred to other political accounts, while reports were required to be filed with the Federal Election Commission. It was the kind of wind-down process that can take months, and it demands careful attention to detail. It was also around this time that Jonathan began experiencing significant health problems.
He started having some gallstone issues spring of 2012. He went into the doctor, and the doctor basically advised him to change his diet, is what he had told us. So he began to somewhat eat healthier.
Despite changes to his diet, Jonathan's poor health continued.
He started complaining of not feeling right, you know, being sluggish, of having headaches, of nausea. And so he said, after this busy time period, I'll go to the doctor. You know, we didn't see him as often on the weekends, and he would occasionally have to take a break from work to, you know, deal with what he's described as sort of blinding headaches. And he started going to have doctor's appointments in June and July. I think it was August, if I remember correctly. I just remember Jamie called me, and I was at a meeting, and she said, you know, come home right after work. John wants to talk to you, and we need to talk. And I was like, well, what's going on? And she said, no, he wants to tell you, I was concerned because he'd been complaining about health issues. And so I asked her to put him on the phone. And when I was on the phone, he told us that, or told me that he had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Multiple sclerosis is a devastating diagnosis for anyone to receive. It's a disease that attacks the central nervous system, disrupting the body's ability to communicate with itself. Symptoms can range from mild numbness to paralysis, even cognitive decline. While treatments can help manage those symptoms, there's still no cure, and the way the disease progresses is often unpredictable.
The prognosis was pretty good. I mean, it's a debilitating disease, but it's a very slow-moving illness. And, you know, Jamie in particular was, anything we can do, we'll do. And she, as was her wont, dove right into research, trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, how do you contain this? You know, and so she would research diets that, you know, there's a diet heavy on kale, and certain nutrients helps like slow or mitigate the effects of MS, for example. So Jamie started cooking more kale at home.
Jamie Nation and their entire circle of friends went out of their way to help Jonathan. One friend offered to drive him to every doctor's appointment. Others brought meals, checked in, made sure he never felt alone. They showed up for him every single day, offering support, comfort, and love.
I came home one day and he was laying upstairs with a wet washcloth over his face. I know at various points he was concerned that there were lesions on his brain, which I think is a common occurrence from MS, and those lesions were growing, like there were more of them. And so he would share, you know, either they stayed the same, they shrunk, they grew, complaining about, you know, walking long distances, and would occasionally be hobbled himself. I remember one time him being, I can't remember what he had forgotten. He's like, you know, damn it, I forgot this, you know, and he would get very frustrated with himself about memory loss issues that he blamed on the multiple sclerosis, or at least believed was a symptom of the MS. It was a pretty frequent topic of discussion.
Eventually, Jonathan's MS began affecting his ability to do his job properly.
There was frustration in August, I think it was. The power was shut off to the campaign office, and so it was, the bills had been paid late. she had to step in. In December, there was a thank you party, and the checks to the catering company, and there was a company that made these sort of memento glasses, were late going out, so she was frustrated by that. That was still when John should have been writing the checks. So John and Jamie had a discussion in November or December about their future working relationship, and John had said, you know, that with the multiple sclerosis and with his health problems, he wanted a less stressful job than being in a political campaign. He wanted, you know, a nonprofit or a 9-to-5. And at the same time, Jamie also knew that her revenue was going to decline, so she couldn't afford to keep paying him as an employee. And so she started helping him look for a job.
Although Jonathan was no longer a full-time employee, Jamie still relied on him from time to time. He knew the ins and outs of the Brad Miller campaign account better than anyone, and with the hard deadline in April 2013, she needed his help to close things out cleanly.
Starting in January, February, March, there were a lot of delays in sort of getting information since John was no longer working with her. You know, he wasn't in their office, you know. So she had to rely on email or text or calls to, you know, to get a hold of him. I mean, obviously we'd see each other as friends, but, you know, if we were going out to dinner with other friends, she wasn't going to sit there and badger him.
But Jonathan's health continued to decline.
He started complaining about more and more health issues. At some point, he went into the doctor in that mid-March period, and they told him that he would need to have his gallstones removed. So he scheduled the surgery. He'd asked Jamie if he could stay with us during his recovery period. And Jamie had said, yes, of course, no problem.
Jonathan's gallstone surgery was on April 2nd, 2013. He spent the next 4 days recovering in the guest room of Jamie and Nation's home. On April 9th, he had a follow-up appointment with his doctor.
I saw John pull up through the window, and he walked in. He looked like he'd seen a ghost. He looked very weak, sort of white-faced. And as he walked toward me, I sort of mouthed, "What's wrong?" And he broke down in tears and sort of collapsed against my chest crying. So I hung up the phone, and I led him into the living room, and, you know, I was asking him what was wrong, and he was crying. Finally, he calmed down. He sat down on the couch. And he said, well, you know, I went for my post-op visit with the doctor today. And he sort of choked up. He said, they found a spot when they were going in to remove my gallstones or whatever it was with the surgery. And they wanted to biopsy that spot. He started crying again. And he said, it's because they think I have pancreatic cancer. I was stunned. I tried to comfort him as best I could. I called Jamie and I said, you know, Jamie, hurry home. And then she came home and he told her also. Jamie and I went upstairs. And that was actually the first time I saw Jamie cry.
The news was beyond devastating. Pancreatic cancer has one of the lowest survival rates of any cancer, less than 15% over 5 years. Jamie and Nation were heartbroken for their friend. They'd already watched him struggle with one life-altering diagnosis, and now he was facing something far worse. To make matters worse, Jonathan told them he'd just been let go from his new job. His health, he said, had caused him to miss too many days. At the same time, Jamie was scrambling to finish the first quarter 2013 report for Congressman Miller's campaign. She needed Jonathan's help, but he was, understandably, unavailable. In fact, Jamie and Nation hadn't even seen him for several days.
He indicated that he just really felt like he needed to get away and that he had gone to the beach. He was sorry he had worried us. He was sorry he didn't pick up. He was sorry he didn't text. You know, that he would be back Saturday or Sunday to help Jamie with the report. But he kept reassuring us, don't be worried. You know, I'm just at the beach. I just need to get away. I'll be back.
Jonathan returned on April 14th and helped Jamie prepare the report. The following day, the two of them met with attorney John Wallace, the official treasurer for the Brad Miller campaign committee.
Sky Blue was a general consultant to the campaign, which included compliance responsibilities of the committee, such as depositing of contributions, the disbursement of checks, maintenance of appropriate records of those contributions and disbursements, and assistance in the preparation of the reports that I was then obligated to review and file with the Federal Election Commission. It was an informal meeting at which documents were provided to me. I reviewed what I saw on the draft report, raised questions to the extent that I had questions. And in this particular meeting, I did have a question because the report showed a continuing indebtedness to Congressman Miller, which I had been led to believe had been retired. And so I noted that discrepancy and requested that the draft report be amended so as to reflect the retirement of that indebtedness.
It was a major accounting discrepancy, tens of thousands of dollars unaccounted for. But later that same day, something else happened that set off even more alarm bells. Jamie received a call from a debt collector on behalf of Time Warner Cable, saying the Miller campaign had an outstanding balance of $591. Jamie was confused. She distinctly remembered sending the check weeks earlier. When she mentioned that to the caller, his response was immediate and concerning. "We got your check. The problem is, it bounced." It didn't make sense. She'd just reviewed the campaign's quarterly report, which showed over $60,000 in the account. A $591 check should have cleared easily. Something was seriously wrong, and it appeared Jonathan had made a serious error. As Jamie was approaching her breaking point, then came another blow. Jonathan told her and Nation that his pancreatic cancer diagnosis had been fully confirmed. Jamie now found herself caught in an impossible position, trying to support her friend through a medical crisis while also protecting the integrity of a federal campaign account. Wanting to ease Jonathan's stress, she asked him to send over the login details for the campaign's bank account. She said she'd take it from there and try to fix whatever went wrong. 1 week later, on April 22nd, Jamie was ready to finalize the report, but before submitting it, she wanted Jonathan to give it one last look. At 1 p.m., she sent him a text message that read, "Hello, love. Just checking in on all this stuff for Brad. Do you want to come over around 4 so we can take care of everything before close of business? Getting this closed out today is a must, mainly for my own sanity." Jonathan replied, "No worries. I will see you then." When Nation got home from work that day, Jonathan was already over at the house.
I walked in our front door through the entryway, and I was on the phone, and I hung up. I saw John was walking through the kitchen. So I went over, gave him a hug, asked him how he's doing. He said, "Yeah, I'm doing okay." I asked him, "Are you going to stay with us tonight?" And he said he thought so. I said, "I'm going to go upstairs and change and go on a run or go to the gym one." I went upstairs and changed out of my work clothes, pulled on basketball shorts, and then I went to use the restroom.
Nothing seemed wrong. Nothing seemed amiss. But in an instant, everything would change.
I was using the restroom, and I heard Jamie scream. And I yelled out, "What?" And I turned to leave the restroom, and I yelled, "What?" again. And she called my name. She screamed, "Nation." But she also screamed, "John." My immediate assumption was that something had happened with him. The way she was screaming his name, it just sounded like something, like he had passed out or something. So I started proceeding through the bedroom as quickly as I could, threw open the door. She was still alternating her names, screaming mine as if sort of come, screaming his in a different way. I was halfway down the stairs and she screamed out, "He's trying to kill me."
Nation rushed to the bottom of the stairs and turned the corner.
There was blood on the floor, and I could see Jamie's legs. And then I looked up, and John was standing over her with a knife. He immediately turned and proceeded towards me. I screamed out, "What the fuck are you doing?" And he came towards me. He had the knife up, and then he sliced it towards me. And my immediate reaction, as best I can remember, was to try to grab the blade or to grab towards it because it was coming towards me. And we immediately started sort of wrestling. I was trying to get the blade from him. At the same time, I was hitting him sort of open face with the palm of my hand, screaming at him, "What are you doing?" And no response. I was also screaming at Jamie to get out of the house. I was screaming for her to leave. Eventually, I mean, she got up. We're wrestling and I could hear the side door swing open. You know, I'm still fighting him, trying to keep him from hurting me. you know, I didn't even realize my hands had been cut. It's very hard to piece together all of it, except that I was trying desperately to get the knife from him. I just know that I created separation. I mean, I think I shoved him with my side, with my arm. But either way, I immediately turned to run and ran through the dining room. And as I ran, I saw him going down the hallway. I ran through the house and got out the side door. I started looking for Jamie. I couldn't see her at the time. The next time I have a very clear memory of her, I was screaming at someone to call 911, and I turned back to her, and she was clutching her side.
The Hunts' neighbor, Julie Harrell, heard Nation's cries for help.
I had no idea what was happening. Nation was yelling out, "Help, someone please help my wife." And I saw Jamie laying at the bottom of the front steps. I could see that she had blood on her. I just assumed that someone had probably been hit by a car or a bike accident. I didn't know anything yet. So when we got down to the bottom of the steps, I had the towels. I knelt down so that my head was right by Jamie's head. We asked Nation what happened, and she said that she had been stabbed. Took us back by surprise. No one expects to hear that.
Julie, who was a registered nurse, began assessing the situation while another neighbor called 911.
And then I was on the ground next to Jamie and was trying to figure out where her wounds were. So she was saturated from her waist down. Her eyes, her pupils were really, really, really small. She was conscious. She was able to talk and respond. But she had another wound that was not bleeding at all, somewhere around her neck area. I remember seeing like tissue, but there was no blood. So my immediate thoughts was that she's already bled significantly because there was no more blood coming out. So I put the towels kind of over her, around her, and then I held on to the wound. Jamie was still able to lock eyes with me, and every now and then you could kind of see her fade out. And then about that time, Jamie was telling me that she couldn't breathe anymore. So she was having real quick breaths. Her pulse, it's a real thready pulse, kind of fading. And I just kept locking eyes with her and telling her, "Don't leave. Don't leave me. Stay right here. You can breathe." You could tell her they were just getting more and more shallow.
As Jamie fought for her life, Nation stayed by her side.
My next clear memory is really just talking to her. And I just remember telling her that I loved her. You know, we said it back and forth, you know, promising her that we would have a lot more anniversaries. I told her we'd go back to the beach as soon as she was better.
Ambulances soon arrived and took Nation and Jamie to the hospital. On the way, Jamie lost consciousness. She would never wake up again.
I felt like she was going to make it. The chaplain had walked in and said, "You know, Jamie's still with us." And it was the happiest that I could ever remember feeling. And then the surgeon came in and said, "She's still with us, and she's exceeding expectations, but she's touch and go, and the next 24 hours will tell the tale." But I just never gave up hope. But finally, the doctor told us that she wasn't, Jamie wasn't going to make it. And so we were with her in the hospital room and sat there, and it was like a little bit before 2 a.m., I think.
After 2 days in critical condition, Jamie died from her injuries on April 24th, 2013. She was 29 years old. She'd been stabbed 4 times, with wounds to her back, abdomen, chest, and neck.
She's so strong. So strong. She was a fighter. Something that I'll always be thankful for was the opportunity to say, "I love you," to the most wonderful person I've ever known.
While Jamie and Nation had been taken away from the crime scene by ambulances, police descended upon their home to find the perpetrator.
We got a call over communications indicating that a stabbing had occurred at that address.
This is Officer Roy Smith with the Raleigh Police Department.
We got updated comments indicating that prior to their arrival, that it was a pretty serious stabbing. I pulled out my patrol rifle from the rear of my vehicle, and we put a perimeter around the house. Officer Morrow began giving verbal commands. We yell so anybody can hear us, "If there's anyone inside, make yourself known." After the third or fourth command, Mr. Boyle stepped out of the house. He was covered in blood from head to toe, and at that point, he collapsed completely on the ground. We ordered EMS to come towards us.
It became apparent that Jonathan had stabbed himself several times.
I saw a self-inflicted knife wound to both his wrists. They were so severe that I can actually remember that I could see skin on both sides of his arm right here, flapping. And that was on both arms, very deep. And I also noticed a what appeared to be a stab wound to his stomach, and I can see his intestines protruding through.
While Jonathan was attended by paramedics, Officer Smith entered the home.
In the kitchen, there was blood all over the walls, a pool of blood on the floor. I noticed a knife was right there by the pool of blood. I noticed, I believe, a chair turned over in the kitchen. Sergeant Wood instructed me to ride with Mr. Boyhill inside the ambulance to the hospital. I get inside the ambulance. He's very quiet. Mr. Boyhill was very quiet. He was on the gurney, lying down, being attended to by emergency medical services. At this point, he asked him some questions as far as, you know, what's going on, you know, what happened. Mr. Boyhill's response was, I just want to die. And he was very upset and began to cry, and he just spoke about wanting to die.
For detectives, nothing about what had just happened made any sense. Jonathan, nation's best friend, the best man at his wedding, had just brutally attacked the two people who trusted him the most, and then turned the knife on himself. But why? Was there something deeper, like a hidden romantic entanglement? Was he upset about being laid off from Sky Blue Strategies? The day after the attack, on April 23rd, Detective Zeke Morris interviewed Jonathan at the hospital. Jonathan admitted to the attacks, but offered no explanation for his actions. What he did admit to was theft. He told Detective Morris he'd embezzled money from the Brad Miller campaign account. When detectives reviewed the account, they uncovered the true extent of that theft.
Between the period of June 2011 through March of 2013, there were 39 checks totaling more than $46,500.
These were checks Jonathan had written to himself, drawn directly from the campaign account. According to investigators, the embezzlement began not long after Jamie first hired him, and it continued quietly, steadily, until the final weeks of her life. But even then, the full picture was still coming into focus. The investigation was just getting started.
The officer asked me if I knew John had pancreatic cancer, and I told him no, I did not know that.
This is Jonathan's mother, Kay Broyhill, who came to visit her son in the hospital.
That's what my mother had passed away with, and Jonathan was very close to her.
As detectives dove deeper into Jonathan's medical history, they uncovered something shocking. Jonathan didn't have cancer, and it wasn't a case of misdiagnosis. There was no record, anywhere, of a diagnosis in the first place. Jonathan had claimed that doctors discovered the cancer during his gallbladder surgery on April 2nd, the one he was supposed to be recovering from in Jamie and Nation's guest room. But that surgery never happened. In fact, detectives found no medical records at all. Not for cancer, not for gallbladder surgery, not even a single doctor's visit in 2013. And it didn't stop there. Jonathan didn't have multiple sclerosis either. Every single medical crisis, every moment that he prompted Jamie and Nation to rally around him, cook meals, and give him grace at work, had been a lie. Detective Morse discovered Jonathan had been researching the illness online, learning enough about the symptoms to convincingly fake them.
A Google search is being done on pancreatic cancer. Another Google search, is it possible for a 30-year-old to have pancreatic cancer? Next search is, what are the risk factors for pancreatic cancer? Next search is, all pancreatic cancer at a young age, medical oncologist at Duke. List of pancreatic cancer doctors at Duke.
As it turned out, Jonathan hadn't just fabricated his illness. He'd borrowed them from people close to him. His grandmother had died from pancreatic cancer. his sister had been diagnosed with MS. He took their real suffering and made it his own. Detectives learned he'd studied both diseases extensively, reading symptoms, side effects, and even treatment plans. It was the research that helped him pull off the lie. To Jamie and Nation, he didn't seem like someone pretending to be sick. He seemed like someone fighting to survive. Nearly 2 years after Jamie's death, Jonathan Broyhill stood trial for first-degree premeditated murder. He was also charged with attempted murder for the attack on Nation. The prosecution's case was straightforward. Jonathan had embezzled thousands from the Brad Miller campaign, fabricated serious medical conditions to avoid accountability, and when he realized he was about to be exposed, he murdered Jamie to keep his secrets hidden. But Jonathan's defense team told a different story.
Jonathan Broyhill held the knife that killed Jamie Hahn. That fact is not in dispute. Her husband, Nation, was injured when he tried to save her. And to make this a nightmare that Nation Hahn can't wake up from, John was his best friend. Any way you look at it, this is a tragedy. The state is going to say that this is about the money and that John lied to distract Jamie and Nation Hahn from his acts. And that when he knew he couldn't get away with the theft anymore, he attacked those he loved. But John had no preconceived motive to kill those he loved, because the undisputed evidence will show that John was determined to take his own life. The evidence is going to paint the picture of a tormented soul who had become so depressed and so despondent that he was ready to end his existence. You'll see that all of his actions, his stealing the money, his lies, it's all so irrational, it's all so bizarre. It doesn't point to a person bent on covering up his crimes. The question of why John turned on his friends might not be answered in this trial. He had no motive to kill those he loved. Something snapped. There was never any premeditation. The facts will show that the only person John planned on hurting that day was himself. There was one motive that drove John to do what he did that night, suicide. What happened on that night was not first-degree murder.
The defense called Susan Simon to the stand, a psychotherapist Jonathan had seen about a year before Jamie's murder.
He talked a lot about not feeling good about himself, feeling worthless, feeling unattractive, that he couldn't find a place for himself within the gay world. He talked about having a history of participating in unhealthy relationships with other men. He complained about low self-esteem. He felt like he had some sexual identity issues. He complained about being depressed, about being anxious. He was unhappy. He was shy. He talked about having grown up in what he called a dysfunctional family. He felt that his mother was unavailable to him when he was a child, that she should never have had kids and that she never really wanted to have kids. He felt like when he was a child, he was seen but not heard, and he was never good enough.
The defense argued that Jonathan had been deeply depressed and suicidal for a long time. They presented this as a part of a strategy to reduce the charge, hoping the jury would convict Jonathan on second-degree murder, not first-degree premeditated murder. But the prosecution wasn't buying it. Detective Morse pointed to the murder weapon itself as evidence of planning and intent.
I located the packaging to an Oneida chef's knife. On the back of the packaging is the UPC code, that barcode that identifies it as an individual item. And I was able to take that UPC code and speak with Representative Harris Teeter to research the sales of this knife.
The murder weapon had been purchased on April 14th. Just minutes before Jonathan sat down with Jamie for their final meeting about the campaign's quarterly report. To prosecutors, the timing said everything. It suggested intent, premeditation, and the lengths Jonathan was willing to go to keep the truth from coming out.
That's his motivation. He's close to being caught. His extensive financial crimes will soon be detected. So that's his state of mind. That is what is important here. His expectations of what was certain to soon occur. So as the April 15th filing deadline approaches, defendant knows that's the date he reasonably can expect to be caught. Then he buys that knife. He buys that knife on Sunday, April 14th. The timing of the purchase of that knife is informative. He buys that knife at 7:40 that Sunday, less than 2 miles from the Hahn's house. This is the meeting right before he's getting ready to go see Jamie. It's the meeting that he has so feared that he cannot avoid anymore. You want to commit suicide. Ask yourself, who must leave their house to go purchase a chef's knife to commit suicide? Why do you leave your house to go to the Hahn's house to commit suicide, whether on the 14th that evening or on the 22nd? You purchase this knife before seeing Jamie Hahn, knowing what the topic is of these outstanding Miller issues, and that what you're getting ready to see. What is she going to request? What is she going to demand? What is she going to ask of me?
The prosecution argued that Jonathan had been planning Jamie's murder for at least a week. They also presented evidence that he'd been making travel plans for April 23rd, the very next day. He'd purchased a train ticket from Raleigh to Charleston and had been researching which countries allow entry without a passport. During closing arguments, the defense offered a different theory, an alternative explanation for Jonathan's actions on April 22nd.
If it was about running away, why didn't he? He had a week. If this was about being confronted and having this come to a head, take off, get in your stolen car and run. I don't know where you're going to go, some other place.
We think that a decision was made to go over there to kill himself, unfortunately, in front of the two people he loves the most, because he wants them to know, I'm in pain. I can't do life anymore. I want it out there. And nobody considered that maybe she walked in on him killing himself and tried to stop him. And this young woman who cared for him like a mother tried to stop him. And we respectfully submit that's what the evidence is supportive of.
In the end, the prosecution debunked the defense's theory with a simple but tragic question.
If he was going to kill himself, why did he stab Jamie in the back? Why did he continue to cut and stab and slice Jamie Hahn? If your motive was suicide, why is Ms. Hahn in her grave? What could that be other than premeditated murder? Jonathan Broyhill was a strange, self-absorbed master manipulator, skilled at effortlessly negotiating all of his elaborate deceptions, who finally revealed himself on April 22nd, 2013. Every aspect of Jonathan Broyhill's life was a lie. His relationship with Jamie and Nation was no different. Then the initial, somewhat head-scratching aspect of this case, that the best friend did this, it's not hard to accept, because that entire premise is a lie. We know that now. Jamie and Nation did not know that then.
When it came time for deliberation, the jury didn't take long to reach their decision. After 90 minutes, they returned with their verdict.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of first-degree murder, count one, guilty of attempted first-degree murder, and count two, guilty of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury.
Jonathan Broyhill was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. During the hearing, Nation's impact statement truly captured the magnitude of what had been lost and the strength it took to survive.
Mr. Arbor, yesterday you said your client was at a point where he was ready to die. Well, first he had to take our lives. Evidence shows that. But I want to make a point that, you know, I can empathize with those feelings you were describing. Because of your client, I was ready to die for a very, very, very long time. I walked around buildings and thought about jumping off of them. I didn't wear my seatbelt because I hoped somebody would hit me. So I can empathize with those feelings you described. I can empathize with the feelings of wanting to die. Because until you've had someone who you love taken from you, you'll never know what it is to hit a valley so deep that you can't see a way out. So deep that you can't imagine ever seeing the light again.
Even as he faced the man who took his wife's life, a man he once called his best friend, someone he trusted with everything, someone he'd welcomed into his home and his family, Nation didn't choose vengeance. He didn't choose bitterness. He chose light.
Because of so many, we've seen points of light. Because of Jamie's light, we've survived. We survived in a world without her, but we've survived. So while we've learned there's evil in the world, we've also learned so much about the essential goodness of others. And I hope that people will take a lesson from the way Jamie lived. It's easy to trust less. It's easy to be suspicious. It's easy to not take people at face value. But I think the lesson that Jamie would want us all to know is that we should still be open to the essential goodness of so many.
And in his final words to Jonathan, Nation delivered a truth that no amount of violence could change.
But you know, we don't win by surviving. We win by the fight that we show, by the strength that we show, by the character that we show. And that was how Jamie lived her life. And she tried to give that same strength, that same care, that same compassion to John Broyhill, because she loved him too. I would give anything to hold her in my arms, to see her make this, what I refer to as a frog face when she was getting ready to kiss me, to kiss her, to hold her, to tell her I loved her again, but I can't. But I hope that everyone will do what I try to do every day, which is take some of her with us, some of her essential goodness, some of her love for others, her care, her concern, her compassion. Because we never really die as long as there are people who love us, who carry our example forward. And all of us who knew Jamie know that that spirit will carry forward with all of us. John, you killed her. You tried to kill me. But you can't kill her spirit. You can't kill what it was that made her so special. You can't cut her spirit out with that knife. And you couldn't stop her love for you even if you tried.
Today, the Jamie Kirk Hahn Foundation carries forward her mission, empowering emerging leaders and fighting for social justice. Through this foundation, Jamie's passion for helping others lives on. Jamie's story serves as both a heartbreaking reminder of how evil can hide behind the most trusted faces, but it's also a testament to the power of love, of community, and the enduring light one person can leave behind. Jamie's light continues to shine in everyone she inspired and in every act of kindness done in her name. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.